What I want to do is talk about drone strikes in the context of current U.S. Military strategy, and I want to describe how drone strikes are the clearest manifestation of an unfortunate tendency, I think, which is caused by unbalanced U.S. power and heightened lately by a series of factors I'll describe, to make war casually, even whimsically. And why this makes for bad and probably counterproductive counterterrorism policy, and certainly bad results for U.S. foreign policy on the whole. And I think this is a failure of democracy, one that actually occurs in a sense in non-security realms, where anywhere really where there's an absence of concentrated costs, that is a group of obvious losers that come from a policy. Here the fact that drone wars seem cheap and its victims are mostly foreign. And that means there's not organization within the polity of dissent. And that prevents congressional debate and scrutiny of the exercise of executive powers. So that's the problem in some ways I'll be describing. And I'm going to draw in describing this on the Stimson Drone Task Force report, one copy of which is left outside, so you might want to scramble out there, which was co-chaired by Rosa Brooks and General John Abizade, and I was on one of the working groups, and therefore I think it's one of the best sort of blue ribbon bipartisan reports you can read, which is a very, very light compliment. Because most of those reports are terrible. And then I'll end by describing what we can do to improve things. And I won't be able to touch on all the questions that are posed in the description of this panel, but I'm willing to try in Q&A. I want to start by echoing what Jeremy Waldron touched on last night, that drones are just a technology that serves policies, and it's those policies that deserve most of our scrutiny. It is a little more complicated than that, as I'll get to later, but let's first talk about those policies. Well, we can take a narrow approach. The Stimson report, for example, notes, as we also heard this morning, that the large majority of drone usage by the U.S. military does not involve armed strikes. It's mostly surveillance, and that the use of armed drones for strikes within the declared war zones of Iraq and Afghanistan is relatively uncontroversial. It's really the use of drones in the gray war zones, the gray areas of Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan, where the controversy, I think, mostly arises. And these are areas, I think, where the technology seems to cause or widen war, generally of a constitutionally dubious variety. But before drilling down onto that bit of things, I think it's useful to consider the broader context of armed drone use, the policies or the approach to U.S. security that has us at a time when our president is criticized on security policy mostly for being overly dovish, that has us participating in, I think, maybe bombing six countries. So I think in talking about the trouble with drones, you got to point first at the bipartisan militarized approach to foreign policy that makes this amount of warfare seem moderate or even dovish compared to the conceivable alternatives in Washington. The belief of the elites in both parties, and the foreign policy elites, that military primacy or hegemony of the United States is indispensable to global stability, and that the United States is also indispensable to the resolution of civil conflict in lots of parts of the world, that every problem is somehow dependent on our benevolence and efforts to solve it. I could talk at length about the origins of this bipartisan consensus, but that's a different talk. While I agree with my co-panelists that strategic coherence is sort of a unicorn, a nice thing to have that doesn't really exist, I do think that there's more coherence than our rhetoric about foreign policy would lead one to believe, because there's this bipartisan belief in primacy, and when you strip away all the rhetoric, they believe in most of the same things. What's more relevant now is how events in the last couple of decades have conspired to make this an especially proprietous time politically for the use of drones and other limited military means, whether they're special operations raids, the training of foreign militaries, or other forms of air power. We could call this a limited liability approach to military strategy, where we seek broad objectives now at very low cost in blood and to a lesser extent treasure, at least when it comes to that of Americans. And I'm going to mention seven factors that have, I think, heightened this tendency in somewhat recent years. First, Special Operations Command expanded greatly during the 2000s with the military buildup going on. It didn't contract when the rest of the military recently had a small cut. And that expansion occurred both to accomplish its traditional SOCOM, Special Operations Command's traditional military-to-military training and support mission, but especially the expansion occurred especially to serve this targeted raid and killing procedures that they were able to practice so much in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also, of course, the operation of drones. Second, a surveillance and precision targeting revolution has occurred over the last couple decades, more really, which has sort of perfected itself, you know, in the post-Cold War era, which made air power not just far more accurate, but in a direct sense, exponentially more accurate, where the number of aircraft required to destroy a set amount of targets or the number of sorties, whatever unit you want to use to measure, has declined exponentially. So we have so much more ability to destroy things precisely. And that's a necessary condition that allows us to use cruise missiles or any aircraft, including drones, to attack things precisely enough that we can go after individuals. Third, in a legal sense, this administration inherited a supercharged imperial presidency thanks to the last administration and Congress that's become accustomed to extreme deference to executive power. And I won't talk much about that because others have already. Fourth, of course, there's the advent of drone surveillance and strike technology that's been perfected primarily over Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also Yemen and Somalia, by both the CIA and Joint Special Operations Command, the operational arm of Special Operations Command. And fifth, there continue to be jihadist organizations mixed up in the insurgencies in a number of nations, and a widely held belief in our country, a belief I think is overwrought, that these groups are inherently a threat to us. So those are all pushes to war. Those are all trends towards the expansive use of military force. But there are a couple countervailing factors. One is that the occupational wars in Iraq and Afghanistan created a big public backlash, historically high amounts of public opposition to war, at least the costly kind that involves a lot of ground forces. And you see that in the run-up to some of the wars we've had, where even politicians who tell you that ISIS is the reincarnation of every terrible threat that we've ever seen before and a grave threat to the livelihood of our children, those same politicians say, but we mustn't send ground forces to go after them. If it's such a big threat, why not? Well, a part of it is this political condition. And I think this syndrome, this anti-war syndrome, which, by the way, I think is a good thing, tragically bought, but a good thing, I think it's likely to last. For a variety of reasons. Another countervailing factor is the deficit. Growing concern about it created calls for austerity and reduced our massive defense spending, or at least reduced it a bit and then held it in check for the last couple of years, and somewhat reduced support for war spending and therefore for wars and made it harder to fund them. So to summarize these trends, these countervailing trends, on the one hand, we have a heightened desire and capacity to use force discreetly. Discreet here is a relative term. And on the other hand, weakened public support for broad or big wars. And that creates, I think, the sort of strategy we see today, which I don't think is a conscious choice of the Obama administration so much as an outgrowth of the conditions it faces, which is the use of military means utterly incommensurate to the ends they are said to serve. To proclaim that the discrete uses of U.S. military forces around the world will produce sort of grand or even revolutionary political results. And that's true of the Libya campaign, of the forces kept in Afghanistan, and the bombing, aid, and training mission we have in Syria, and also the special operations forces activities in various African countries, which are justified based on rather sweeping claims about the political changes this minor thing in the grand scheme of things can cause. So it's not just drones. Indeed, most of the complaints we are expressing here and I'm expressing here could have been applied during the 1990s, I think, when victory in the Cold War and the Gulf War created an infatuation, a newfound infatuation with strategic air power, manifest most clearly, I think, in the war over Kosovo. And in those bombing efforts of that infatuation with strategic air power, I think, is part of what political scientist Elliot Cohen calls the mystique of American air power, the idea that aircraft can allow us to win wars through technology at little risk to our troops, even our airmen, and that we can solve political problems through the application of technology. And that the mystique of American air power itself is sort of an outgrowth of what Russell Wegley, the historian, called the American way of war, where we tend to replace labor with capital or technology to maximize firepower. And Wegley says, well, this is a result of the condition of the United States over its history, which was that labor tended to be scarce, and we tended to have a lot of capital, which we could use, and technological prowess. So we had the luxury to do this, and I suppose that's right, but I think another cause of it, our tendency to approach war this way, is our power and our geography, which make us both uniquely safe from traditional foreign attack and capable of exercising power all over the world, of using force all over the world. We're unique in our capability to pursue global military objectives, but our safety, born largely of geography, makes the stakes of those foreign conflicts esoteric. The justifications for war, even if you believe in them, are rather esoteric. They're not the opposing army is coming into the capital if we lose. And then because they're esoteric, they're unlikely to stir the populace to offering its life or even its support for great amounts of sacrifice. We only really fight wars of choice in the United States. So we're always looking for ways to limit the human and economic cost in order to sustain, at least the advocates of war are always looking to minimize the cost to sustain public support, or at least public acquiescence. And drones are arguably the perfect example of this tendency. They do, I think, accomplish something. I think they're quite good at surveillance and providing information for targeting and also for more general intelligence purposes. And though it's quite hard to judge their efficacy and their effect on terrorist capabilities, I think there is evidence that they're disruptive to the activities of the organization of people who are downrange, who are members of the organizations that are being targeted. But of course, drones don't fix the underlying causes of disorder in the places they're used. And indeed, the same can be said for basically any other U.S. military tool, even ones of far greater cost. Some people look at drones and they'll ask, what's the problem? Look, even if drones or special operations forces or military aid or something like that fails to achieve its aims, its grandiose aims, well, they're cheap, right? They're sustainable in that they don't create destructive or prohibitive costs. So if the risks are low, the lack of reward is arguably inconsequential. So what's the problem? Well, I think one necessary point to make whenever somebody talks about sustainability is it's not the same thing as wisdom. In life and politics, a lot of dumb acts are sustainable, at least for a while, especially if you're rich. And the United States is rich, so we can have a foreign policy that wastes that does a lot of dumb things for a long time and get away with it, and we do. Economist Herb Stein gave us Stein's Law, which says if something can't go on forever, it will stop. And I think that it's obvious, right? But it's strangely obvious and insightful at the same time. The tricky part of public policy is less unsustainable policies, which tend to produce politics conducive to their end, than unsustainably dumb policies, because they bleed you a bit, but not enough to organize an opposition that stops things. And I think that's a real problem for our democracy. And the problem's especially acute when the costs are not so much low as hidden, which is probably the case with drone warfare. Because the costs are downrange in the form of dead people and who have families that can't vote because they're foreign, and the costs are also often uncertain, and they come in the form of things like hostility that are hard to price, the costs of drone warfare are arguably off the books, which means they're hard to see, but still present and still a liability. So what are these costs or risks? Well, first, there's the moral costs of making war casually, without democratic debate, and killing innocents in that circumstance. And because prior panels have focused on this, I won't, except I will say that it's too often the case that in these discussions, at least in Washington, morality is included in the discussion only as a means to an end. So we'll say, you know, we shouldn't torture people or kill innocents while making war because there might be blowback, or because then the enemies might do the same thing to us. But of course, this group will understand that it's enough to call something immoral. That's a sufficient reason not to do it. You don't need to have another strategic conversation about what morality does for you. Second, drones are more expensive to taxpayers than they seem. The Stimson report goes into this. The operational costs are actually rather high. So although the aircraft itself is cheap, they're not as cheap as they seem. Third, there's a risk that drones might erode the norm of sovereignty, which serves U.S. interests and peace generally. This has been the case for a lot of aircraft and other things, other technologies the United States uses, but drones, I think, because of their number and their low altitude, arguably make the problem worse. We could create bad precedents in this regard. And sovereignty is an important thing for peace. Historically, it's a peace program, and I think it's not the subject here, but it's been eroded lately by people who have well-meaning intent in terms of humanitarianism. They've eroded the norm of sovereignty, and I don't think we want to continue that. The fourth problem is blowback, where strikes, even when they're successful in terms of killing terrorists, create resentment in affected communities enough to make them support or even become terrorists that attack the United States. So the strikes do more harm than good. And blowback can also mean generating support for not necessarily terrorists, but anti-American insurgents, or just policies or diplomacy or non-cooperation with U.S. policy goals, and hurt U.S. interests in that way. And blowback gets raised a lot in discussions like this. It's always sort of on the list, but it's mostly as a hypothesis or a question. That's because it's so difficult to measure the benefits of drone strikes and the costs in terms of blowback, but not equally so. I think an issue is that the benefits are immediate. They're at least more immediate. They're more, it's easier to see the benefits. They're more discernible. And yet the costs, if they're blowback, are sort of a slow boil that doesn't manifest itself right away. So even if you're looking at blowback and trying to do cost-benefit analysis, you might not be able to in present time. And one reason I think to believe in blowback is what we know about historically about strategic bombing campaigns. You know, the famous World War II strategic bombing survey. And what that all tells us is that even quite intense violence perpetrated on societies, in that case, Nazi Germany, tends to make the government or the insurgency under attack more popular with those it governs, partly because they become more dependent on it when you bomb them. And also to heighten the bombing heightens usually violent resistance to the bombing state, and that resistance tends to be mobilized by nationalism and other forms of identity politics, including the radical religious variety. So that's blowback. A fifth form of risk with drones is a self-fulfilling prophecy danger, where for fear that Islamist insurgents are planning to attack us, that is, that they're anti-American terrorists, we behave as if they are already. And so we take people who are consumed with local struggles, and though they might not like the United States of America, not particularly interested in killing Americans, because we bomb them, change that and make them into what we feared they were. And I think that's occurred. The sixth risk, I think, is that that makes the cost of drones more than is obvious is the danger of slippery slopes to endless or wider war. And here I want to quote the Stimson report because it lays out the causal pathways pretty clearly. The seemingly low risk and low cost missions enabled by UAV technologies may encourage the United States to fly such missions more, pursuing targets with UAVs that would be deemed not worth pursuing if manned aircraft or special operations forces had to be put at risk. UAVs also create an escalation risk insofar as they may lower the bar to enter a conflict without increasing the likelihood of a satisfactory outcome. And they explain why that is, why we get sucked into these conflicts, because we try to solve, having begun to participate in a problem with a technology that doesn't solve it, we commit ourselves to solving it and thus tend to get sucked deeper into the problem. And the report goes on to say that if UAVs were not a problem, if drones were not an option, that the United States probably wouldn't have engaged in most of these conflicts. So to repeat what was said earlier, the alternative to drone strikes, contrary to what their advocates usually say, is not some other form of warfare, but peace. I think a final problem with drones, or perhaps a manifestation of that last slippery slope one, is the danger they create for our constitutional system. It's not that big an exaggeration to say that we're in an era of sort of iTunes or why not wars, where we bomb countries with minimal debate and democratic consideration because the cost is low. And when you buy a car, you think a lot about what it costs and you debate it. When you buy an iTunes song, it's 99 cents, so why not, right? We have wars like that now in the United States. The war in Libya cost $2 billion. It was barely debated by Congress. It was a why not war. The Benghazi thing has been debated 100 times more than the decision to make the war in Libya. There was no authorization. There was not even an appropriation. And drone strikes, of course, are like that. By easing the onset and expanding these low-cost wars, drones make it easier for Congress to abrogate its responsibilities, and no constituents get mad at them, so they can take a pass, and they do. And that, whatever the president said in that speech he gave in 2013 that's been mentioned a couple times, not a thing really has changed since then. The president gets to make these decisions in a room alone with his lawyers, and Congress lets him. And it's I think, not a very useful use of anyone's time to go complain to the president about it. That's what presidents do, right? That's the United States Constitution expects people to grab at powers. And what Congress has failed to do, to use Edwin Corwin's famous phrase, is they've not taken up the Constitution's invitation to struggle for the privilege of directing U.S. foreign policy. And that the technology fuels that because it's so cheap. And I think that's really the most insidious problem with drones, because we can't even make good judgments about these policies. I'm not opposed to drone strikes everywhere, but I don't think I can make a judgment about their wisdom in various cases, because nobody makes the administration come before Congress and say why it thinks these strikes are a good idea, and the information remains secret. The wars remain covert. It's hard to know in what cases they might make sense. I have to wrap up, having not left time for my list of policy changes, but I will say that a couple things. One is I agree with the congressman who said last night we should have fewer covert wars. Covert wars are inherently undemocratic, and because they're inherently undemocratic, they're more likely to be dumb, because the division of powers, the balance of powers, checks and balances is not just a formalistic thing that we should do because people alive long ago wearing wigs said so. It's a public policy theory about what produces good policy outcomes, and people who aren't, whose beliefs aren't interrogated and who aren't asked to justify themselves are more likely to make dumb decisions. So I think that's a big one. Getting rid of the AUMF is a big one. And most importantly, perhaps, I think the unfortunate circumstances we've experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan make this a good time for reviving the anti-militarist ideology that used to be a more popular thing in the country. And that's something that doesn't require getting Congress to do anything. It can be done by, you know, the sorts of organizations that people here work for. And I will just say, finally, I think it's important, you know, to cast a broad, to have a broader tent. So if you just say, we're going to accomplish all the things we were trying to accomplish in solving the problems of Yemen or Mali, except we're going to do it with the State Department, you lose a lot of people on the right. And I wouldn't consider myself to be on the right, but you lose me, because I don't think the State Department has the magic dust that makes solves those political conflicts either. So I agree with my co-panelists that one thing we can just do is stop and say we're going to do less. We can't solve all these problems. And I think that offers a chance of a broader political coalition built around the idea, in part, that wars should be hard to start. I'll stop there.